Hello, my fans, friends. Welcome to the Rich Herring podcast feed, powered by Acast Plus. Thanks to everyone who's come to see the Can I Have My Ball Back tour so far. It's been going really well. I've got a 4-star review in the Standard, 4-star review in the Telegraph, who once called me the worst comedy experience of the year, so that's a turnaround. People have been coming, people have really been enjoying it, and it's getting better and better. The only gigs this week are both in Pocklington, the town I was born in, near York. There's a couple of tickets left for the evening show and a few more tickets left for the matinee, I think about 4:30. But love to see you there, Yorkshire. Pop along. Check richardherring.com/ballback/tour or richardherring.com/gigs to see if I'm coming near to you. There are tickets left for nearly every show in the tour. I think Norwich has sold out. And a couple of gigs in London could do with your support as well. Anyway, please listen to the podcast. Do spread the news about the podcast to your friends. Listen as much as you can. Numbers are slightly down, which may affect the future of this podcast. So just leave it playing, even if you're not in the room. Love you. Now sit back, relax, and enjoy whatever it is you're going to listen to.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello, my fan friends. Welcome to another Rahulastapa Book Club. This week, I'm delighted to be joined by the magnificent Josie Long, whose book, I have to read it off the front because it's so long, I can't remember what it's called. It's called Stories, Because I Don't Know What You Mean and What You Don't, by Josie Long. Josie Long can really write, says Dawn French on the front. Hello, Josie. How are you doing?
Hello.
It's lovely to see you. And friend of the podcast, been on the podcast before, but not on the book podcast. And this is a collection of short stories, which is an interesting way to go. And I would like to know why you wanted to write short stories.
Well, it was something I liked doing ever since I was a kid, really. And it was something that I really felt was like something I was going to do and wanted to do. And when I was at uni especially, I was like, yeah, I mean, I do comedy, but like my real thing is writing short stories, blah, blah, blah. And then I think comedy's quite all-encompassing for me. So like when I'm doing a tour, it's just that. And I find it really hard to do other stuff on the side. But I still had this kind of desire to try and make it work. And then I started thinking about it in 2016 and wanting to do it. And then yeah, it was the pandemic that actually gave me a bit of space to do it. So it's something that, like, it's like when people say, oh, I'm a writer, and they don't write anything. And I was like that for ages. I was like, oh, I write short stories. And they were like, how many have you done? Like, one every 5 years.
I enjoyed writing. I wrote for one of those Robin Ince collection of horror story books. And it is an interesting thing to do. I think that to try and get a story into into that framework of a few thousand words and it's over. I think the problem is sometimes that you write something and, I mean, what's interesting about this book, a lot of them are snapshots. So a lot of them, you know, it's just a little moment from someone's life or a little incident from someone's life. And so, and this isn't a criticism. Some of them you kind of go, oh, I want to know more about those people I want to see a bit more of that. So it's quite, you know, although I suppose like a really successful short story in a way, you read it. Which again, many of them are like, you read it and go, fantastic, I love that, and that's the world over with. So that's not, you know, it's a strange thing, because a successful one is enclosed in its own world, but also it's a sort of success to do one that isn't enclosed in its own world that you want to see more of, right?
That's interesting.
It's quite a tricky format, I think, to work in because of that.
Yeah, I think it is. It's so interesting. It's just I just kind of am interested in what I'm interested in. And so because I've like really want to do it, I'm like, this is what I really want to do. And then people are like, oh, it's that's a difficult thing. And I'm like, oh, everything else seems impossible to me. This seems possible. Okay. So I like doing this. Like the idea of trying to write a memoir or something, I couldn't possibly do it.
I think as a reader, I found it interesting. And I've read short story collections before, but not for a while. But I found, because, you know, I'm sort of reading books and trying to get through books, but I had to stop. I had to stop after each one and I thought, oh, this would be quite an easy book to read because they're all quite short, you know, short stories. I could probably knock this off quite quickly. But if I tried to move on to the next one, I realised I couldn't get my brain into it quickly, you know, straight away from the last one. So I had to stop and then go away and then come back and read the next one. So,
that makes you feel really proud, honestly. Yeah, it's genuinely, I cannot like contain the excitement of like having people read it and talking about it. It is fucking wild. It's amazing. Even people being like, I didn't like that one, I'd be like, oh, someone didn't like that one. Do you know what I mean? It's like above and beyond exciting for me.
I do, but I think, you know, that's going to be, it's like writing a sketch show in that people are going to watch a sketch show and go, I like that one, but that was a bit hit and miss. And, you know, because they won't say this is hit and miss, but they'll say of a sketch show because they like a certain one. So, you know, there's ones that you like more and ones that you like less. Yeah. So, you know, but then that's the beauty of it as well, because a novel, if you're not enjoying it, or if you don't like a bit of it, that's probably the end. Whereas this one, you can go, okay, well, this one's, you know, this one I'm not interested in, but the next one I am. Although I was, you are correct, interested in all of them. They're all, there's a lot, obviously, it was written down during lockdown, and lockdown feels like a sort of thematic thing going through it. There's a few that are about the madness of lockdown.
There's one.
They all have the feel of it, I think, though. You know, there's one that's specifically about lockdown, but they have this feeling of being sort of trapped. I mean, the last one sort of has a feel of, I mean, it's about parenthood. I guess the thing is, a lot of it's about parenthood because you've got two kids. And
this is true.
And I think that there's a similar feel to lockdown and being a parent in that you're trapped.
Yeah. You're trapped. I went to do gigs in Australia and everyone was like, oh my God, the flight, you're going to have the worst time. And then I was like, this is just one shit day that's better than lockdown. I'm like, what is everyone going on about? Like at the end of it, we get to be in Australia. Like why is everyone saying this is bad? This is fine.
But there are a few things that sort of come, there's quite a lot of, I mean, again, there feels that there's quite a lot about relationships. There's a lot about the past. And about past relationships and dealing with past relationships, dealing with body image issues. I mean, these are obviously things that are in your mind that you're thinking of, and the different characters, and they're not all you, obviously. But it is quite interesting how those themes of parenthood, you know, looking back. I mean, I think I don't know if that's just something that happens as you're a parent or something as you hit middle age. I have sort of sleepless nights where I get obsessive. I couldn't sleep a couple of months ago because I was thinking about the girl who sat opposite me in English A level, who I quite fancied, and I think fancied me a little bit, and went out with my friend. I couldn't quite remember a name for a bit, then I did remember it, so I was obsessing over that. And I was feeling really sad about the fact, and we had no relationship beyond being friends. I started feeling really sad about this past, you know, very minor infatuation I had with this girl.
And it
just seemed incredibly important. And I'm very, it wasn't like, oh, I'm unhappy in my life. If only I could go back to being 18. It was a terrible time being 18. And now I'm very happy. So there seems to be a few things like that. I mean, some more serious than that, I have to say, where the characters are backward looking and trying to process the past and old relationships, it seems, comes up a lot.
Yeah. Definitely. I mean, for me, that was something that I wanted to do, I think, through writing this. There was definitely like things that I wanted to process and exercise, and it was useful to fictionalize them. Yeah, I think so. I mean, I hate to always go on about the same thing, but like having ADHD is like in part about ruminating about the past or worrying about the future, like creating like a lot of like internal, like rumination is the word, and like things like that. So I mean, it's definitely like part of me to sort of think of those things, and definitely to have like that kind of romantic, unbearable feeling of like, oh God, someone I nearly had a crush on 10 years ago. Like, I feel that so hard. And do you know what? I did a tour recently with the musician James Yorkston, who's so fucking amazing. And he, I think, is in his, I think he might be in his late 40s, early 50s. And he's written this record, which is very much about, I'm here, I'm looking to my child who's becoming an adult, and I'm looking to my father who's becoming older, and I'm in the middle and able to see forwards and backwards. And that feeling of like middle age where you're like far enough away to acknowledge you're never going to be able to go back to there.
Yeah.
But you're far enough away from there to like really see it on the horizon.
Yeah.
And so I think like writing these at this stage of life really was like that. It was like, oh, I've done enough that I really have things to pick over and think about and like yearn for that I can't go back to, but I'm like here and I can really feel that like that's on the horizon, and it's not necessarily like, what was that? I think there's a lyric in, I think it's James Jackson's lyric about like, if you think, welcome to life, if you think the first half was bad, get ready for the second. It's like amazing. But yeah, I think also, in terms of my writing of it, I feel like in quite a good settled place. So it was kind of great to be able to try and write it from here, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, well, there's, you know, I think it's exactly that, as a sense of perspective. And it's like the, you know, the humour of the perspective and the sad and the sadness and the tragedy of the perspective. I think looking back at the boyfriend who was, you know, had been to India and seemed very cool when the person was young, and realising, you know, in hindsight, I mean, again, yeah, exactly. You have to go, we'll have to go through it with our own kids as we watch them make terrible mistakes. And, you know, obviously, Josie, you're a very funny comedian and a
person.
Thank
you, that's very kind.
But this book, whilst there are funny ones in there, and there are kind of, there's some dystopian ones that are quite worrying. And there are some very serious ones very sad ones and tragic ones. I think my favourite one, I think the one that gets it has the biggest emotional punch, but I think just really, it's not a funny one, is the 2021 one, which is again, which has this, that was the one that I kind of, you know, the writing's great, but it throughout the book, that one just, I was in that world, and it's, you know, it sort of slowly draws you into its sort of emotional punch, I suppose. There's a sort of gut punch in there. So, you know, there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of serious thought in there, and you're not forced to go for the laugh all the time.
I mean, you must have found this like writing in other mediums. It was so incredibly like freeing to be able to just be like, oh no, I can see where this story goes and follow the tone of it, and I don't have to undermine it every 30 seconds or shorten it for a laugh or change it because it has to be a comedic thing. Like, just the fact that you can be like, no, I just want to like write something that's trying to be as pretty as it can be, or like as meaningful as it can be, or like really be true to the emotions that I'm trying to like explore. It was amazing to be able to kind of broaden out my voice in that way. Like, it felt really like, oh, there's loads of stuff I've not been able to do in stand-up, which is a shame, because you like to think there would be no limits to stand-up, you know, but it'd be hard to do a show that was about that, you know, for
me. Yeah, of course. Yeah, well, it would be hard to do definitely a funny show, but I think it really, you know, that one, I think works really well. The one about the girl and the bike and the sort of slight dystopian version of the internet, which and again, I don't want to talk about them too much, but that one sort of is funny, but also, you know, has a bit of a sort of tales of the unexpected element.
Oh, nice!
Which is not, so that's very, but I feel that one could be, you know, that it feels sort of 1984 or something like that, doesn't it? It feels like that could be expanded out into something bigger, just that idea.
With those ones, there's that one which is about kind of a girl, I suppose I don't want to give too much away, but a girl who's like, work is in part to do with digital surveillance, is what I would say. And like, then there's one about a woman in a commune in the future, and there's one about a woman who's having to interact with this very dystopian government agency, and then there's another one about some girls who try to defraud the super rich. Right. And, like, try really hard to, like, rob from the super rich. And, like, all of those, I was thinking, like, I think they're my way of processing, like, the laws the government's passing and how to cope with them, you know, like, thinking about the fact that they're cracking down so hard on protests. Like, the public order bill, I mean, it literally does say that you can't speak publicly about a protest if you're an activist. You know, there are things in it that are as bad as in those stories. You know, the same with, like, the... my brain is too crummy, but, like, basically the day that they did the PCSC bill, I think I wrote the short story about the woman interacting with the agency, and I wrote it in like one go, and it was basically all of my terror about that just blurt out. And, like, to me, I think that I really do think that the government is that bad, and I really do feel kind of bleak about a lot of stuff. And again, like, with stand-up, I don't want to write shows that are bleak. I want to write shows that have a bit of joy and defiance to them. But sometimes in the stories, I think it's been possible to still have them be a bit defiant and a bit joyful, but to very clearly be like, no, I think it's this bad and irredeemable.
Yeah.
Like, which is kind of it's like useful.
It is great for that. I saw you in you interviewed about this book, saying the thing about stand-up is it sort of disappears even if you record it, it's in the moment, disappears. It's one of the things I like about stand-up. I like the fact that, you know, even if it is recorded, that most of the best moments of stand-up happen in the moment, in a room, and, you know, if you create a really special experience, you know, that everyone in that room's going to think back about that, but it will never be recreated. I kind of like that. But you talk about books enduring, and the kind of exciting thing about this is that, you know, this book could be put. I mean, that is, I do like that. I like when you're in an old pub or something and there's a bookshelf of really old books, and you can pick one out and it probably will be a load of nonsense from Victorian era that you can't understand. But, you know, it's still there and it's still possible to.
This is what I like, yeah.
Read it. Yeah.
If mine can be sold by the yard in 100 years to make some dickhead's house look really uniform, I'll be thrilled. To be sold by the yard?
I mean, it's true. So there's that possibility that I feel, you know, I'd look at, and especially doing this podcast, but also having some books out. And when you go into a bookshop, I find it quite depressing, I have to say. You go into a bookshop and my books, if they're there, somewhere, there's one of them and it's hidden away, and it might often be in the wrong section because my books kind of often overlap between health and men's health and mental health and comedy.
But this is it. This is why you got to write fiction. It's in fiction. There's no fucking about. It's in fiction.
But it is, you know, it's such a competitive market. And yes, it's a wonderful thing to get books published. It's absolutely, you should be as joyful as you are, which I'm delighted to see, because a lot of people, I think, don't understand what an achievement it is, I think, to get a book published and into bookshops. But it is, you know, when you might be one of the authors that ends up on the tables, Josie, I don't know, but I'm not. I'm not one of the authors.
Imagine
who
that. I'm not dream one of being on the table. Do you know what I dream of? Once going in somewhere, you know, where they have the staff pick.
Yeah.
Oh my God. If I am ever a staff pick, I will die of happiness.
I'm sure you will be a staff pick. But yeah, I think at the Cheltenham Book Festival, they had tables of my books, nearly all of them, in the bookshop, but that's the only time it's ever happened. I was at the festival, so you know.
But you know who bought those books?
No one.
Spies. Spies.
Well, yeah, Cheltenham spies. Yeah,
spies. You just had nothing but spies.
But it's you know, it's that, I find it quite interesting that you know, that disconnect. And so I think someone on Twitter this week was writing about how they'd looked into the metrics of it, and successful authors was entirely down to the marketing. So, you know, obviously the people know who they think are going to sell, so they market them. So it's a bit of back and forth. But the books that do well are the ones that are marketed well. And then you look at all these other hundreds, thousands of books sometimes in a bookshop, and you know how hard everyone has worked to write those books. And you also know that most of them are going to go largely unread. It's kind of...
This is bringing me to earth.
Well, that's why I think that's, you know, I think what your enthusiasm's great, but I think that's, you know, I think at least stand up, I just wanted to debate this thing. You know, stand up, you know who's seen it. You know there are people there, that if there are there. If there's no one there, then that's depressing as well, but you don't tend to do the show. And at least you have that, and it's sort of in the memory. Whereas a book, I suppose that, you know, I do love books, and I do love all the things you're saying about them. And I do love that potential that book can be opened anywhere at any time by anyone. You know, I like it when you see someone in another country, you know, someone in Africa's reading.
Oh, yes.
That's mind-blowing.
Can I just say, there's no guarantees with anything, and there's no real permanence with anything, you know? Like, we want to say, people will remember a really good stand-up show. Yeah, maybe, but they might not even remember it in the way that we do. And they might forget the bits that we thought were important. Like, you know, so often you'll be sharing a shared memory with a friend and they won't remember the bits that you thought were, like, most significant. You know?
It's true. And I think, I agree with you. And I think my point about stand-up is actually not being remembered. It's the fact that it exists in the moment. I didn't make it very well, but I think that is the point that it doesn't, you know, yeah, there's no point in trying to be, you won't be remembered, even if you, you know, even Richard Osman won't be remembered in 200 years' time. Even someone as
the stature of him. Might be like Charles Dickens.
He won't.
Who's going to be like Charles Dickens?
It's a good question. He might be. But it might be Richard.
You should tell him.
It'd be terrible if it's Richard Osman. What a terrible world that would be. But even in 10,000 years, I mean, it's kind of nice that those Latin guys, you know, those Roman guys end up, some of them, by the chance of surviving, we still get to read their work. But eventually everything goes. So what I'm saying is enjoy your life in the moment, Josie, and don't worry about the future. I don't do it enough. I enjoy everything retrospectively. But six months later, I go, oh, that was good. Oh, I'm not doing it anymore.
Wait, to talk about the book, like, again, I mean, these are a lot of people who are, like, for whom the present moment is kind of unbearable. Like, a lot of the characters, the thing that I've realised that I've done thematically, I guess, throughout the book is that lots of people are trying to kind of use mindfulness and breathing techniques to cope with a systematically cruel and unfair world or abusive situations that these techniques are not designed for. And it's because, like, there's nothing else for them, you know, there's nothing else available. So it's people trying to kind of, like, deep breathe themselves out of crisis.
Yes,
you know?
Yeah. It's incredibly, it's a bleak book. But it will.
It's not as well. It's like everything's wonderful.
It is, but it, you know, it does that. It does make you think a lot about these things. It's very. I mean, that's the beauty of it. That these short stories, and most of them, you know, some of them are only to 4 or 5 pages long. Some of them are a bit longer, but they will make you think about things. And I also like the fact that it's not spoon fed. You do have to, as a reader, you have to work. That's what I mean as well about stopping between them. Because it's not like each one goes, hello, my name is Ian Harris. And I
love it if it was about Ian Harris.
I'm depressed about this. You have to, you know, you have to enter the world each time and find your way in. And I think that's what's, you know, that's what's great about it, because it's not, you're not spoon feeding the reader. It's not, you know, the reader has to do a little bit of work. And also you have to find your way in. But there's, you know, not that you haven't given the way in, but it's, and not that it's, I'm not saying it's difficult to read. I'm saying it's clever the way you've done it.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing.
Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Can I say, I really appreciate how much you've been very kindly not insulting me.
I'm trying not to insult you. Well, but I'm aware that all these things can be taken as an insult.
it's very hard to discuss something that's that complicated, especially when somebody loves it. You know,
yeah, it's true. But if you say that, that's what language is. If you say things in a different tone of voice or whatever, you know, I mean, I would like to see you write something longer and more involved as well. But it is, you know, it's good value for money. You get a book with a lot of stories in it. And a lot of ideas in it.
I try to be good value. I would love to write a novel, but it feels at the currently impossible. But that's how writing a screenplay felt, and I did do that. So also, I'm going to get on government mandated speed soon, and then I imagine
okay,
it'll just fly out, you know.
So the ADHD doesn't really. I mean, it's there in the background of you writing it. And you've been recently, as all comedians, I'm refusing to get the diagnosis.
I mean, you should do it, Richard.
I took a test online and it said I didn't have ADHD, and I thought, well, there's my show. But the one comedian who doesn't have ADHD, even though I clearly do. That was quite a recent diagnosis, right? That you got of that. Is that helping you?
2.5 years ago, yeah, it did help massively just because it gave me a key to understanding my life and its peculiarities and myself and lots of things. It did help massively. And yeah, I think that like there's a lot of ADHD in the book in terms of people with very, very overactive internal monologues and people who are like feeling and thinking things at a very high pitch. When I was growing up, my mum very much lived as if she was like Madame Bovary or something, but she was in Orpington, and like she had like a very kind of leading lady emotional world, and I now really understand that to be ADHD, and I'm really glad for like performing because it gives me an outlet to be that then can like calm me down the rest of the time. I think but yeah, that to me is like what some of the stories are about, is about people who are kind of more melodramatic than their circumstances allow.
Yes. Okay. That's fair enough. I mean, yeah, it is interesting to think about. I mean, during lockdown, I discovered I had aphantasia. I've talked about it a lot on the podcast, in which I means I can't form mental images in the same way other people. I don't have a mind's eye, but I can imagine stuff. And
it's
I can,
a neurodivergence.
Yeah. And so it's interesting to think that, you know, when you say that, we think, well, surely everyone thinks like a lot and has an internal monologue. But of course, some people don't even have an internal monologue at all, which is very hard. That's hard to imagine. And I can't imagine.
Also, I feel like those people should be. I know everyone wants to talk about how they have ADHD and I love it. But I would love it if those people were like, by the way, I have no internal monologue. You are speaking to an empty shell. Because it would be very calming for me. I'd be like, they're not thinking about me because they're not thinking. You know,
they must be thinking something. They must be thinking in some way. But you know, but I can't explain how I can visualize stuff without seeing it, and I can't really explain it. It's like, you know, it's like something's happening behind my field of vision, and I can think of my child's face, but I can't see it. So I know what my child looks like. Some people don't know my children look like. Some people can't remember faces at all. I can pretty much remember. I'm not great at remembering people's names, but I'm good at remembering faces.
You know, I think I have a similar thing, which is I don't really think in images. I can just about drag them up, but it almost hurts to try and do it.
Right.
But I do think in some kind of impression that is like a mental impression. It's like a feeling almost of that picture. Yeah, is that what you have?
That's the same as me. You've got that. We've got the same. We should swap diagnoses and
okay. Do you have trouble function? Do you have trouble finishing things?
I mean, sort of. I mean, sometimes not. I think it's really easy for a comedian to assume they've got ADHD, and I do so much stuff that's always flirted around with obsession. I find obsession and madness, you know, interesting and interesting to explore comedically. And I think comedy and mental illness, I should say, sort of, they dance along the same path, you know, and like, and so like a lot of the stuff I'm doing, certainly my pet projects, are basically a mad person, which again, I think why this book resonated for me and why the lockdown thing feels so, you know, even though it's not, it feels there without being in everything, is that in lockdown, I was really able to explore that crazy man in an attic, you know, a lone man clearing stones off a field and playing snooker against himself and talking to puppets. But I'm aware that if I was mentally ill, I wouldn't necessarily be aware that those things are mentally ill, though sometimes.
Although I would say we've got to be careful with our terminology, because ADHD is not a mental illness. It's neurodivergence, isn't it?
It is.
If only you could recover. No, I don't mean that at all. But I love it. But sometimes you do feel like, especially when I first got diagnosed, I was a bit like, and so what can I do to make me neurotypical? Yeah. And then it was like, nothing, babe. You're absolutely stuck.
But then it's what makes comedians who they are. It's what, you know, it's why that works for so many people. And, you know, and I think that's it. I would rather be able to, you know, I don't think not being able to say mental images is a great thing. Having a butterfly mind and having a mind that overthinks, I think, in a creative way is a lovely thing to have. But maybe not having the mental images means that the verbal thoughts are more intense I do love language. So go on.
It must have been wild to find it out at this stage of life. Like, that was the thing that was so weird, was to be like, you're kidding me, for decades I didn't realise this thing. And nobody else thought to just point it out. And for you, like, for decades, not to appreciate or to understand that other people's thinking was so different to yours, you know?
Yeah. But, you know, I don't, until I found out, I didn't, I think if you'd asked me, I'd have said, oh, yeah, I can, you know, I imagine things and I see pictures, until I tried to do it and realised I couldn't do it. I was sort of surprised that I couldn't do it as well, as much as not being able to do it. So I kind of, in my mind, I thought I could see things in my mind, but I couldn't. Is, you know,
but because you don't know,
because someone put a fucking thing on Twitter, I think it was Bethany Black, actually, thanks Bethany, put a thing saying, can try and imagine an apple, these are the five ways that people who try to, and some people can see a three-dimensional apple, they can spin around. Adam Buxton can do this, he's one of the first person I've talked to, so they can base, they can basically, a movie, a colored apple that's three dimensions, they can spin and turn around. Some people see a kind of slightly faded color, some people see a black and white apple, some people see a flat apple, and some people see nothing or hardly anything at all. And so if I think
I see hardly anything at all.
Yeah, you're the same. So now I've ruined your life. You've got two things now.
Isn't fair. Yeah, although I have conceptions of things.
Yeah.
Is how I describe it.
Yeah, me too.
Must be why things like hypnotherapy don't work in the same way for me.
Yeah. Well, that's what I was thinking. You know, when they go back to a time when you think of a place where you were happy. And, you know, I can, I have the concept of, you know, I have a place I go to when I think of that, but I can't fucking see it. You know, I just have.
Where do you go?
There was when I was on holiday in Thailand in 2001. Nice. I was on holiday with Judith Suwala, where I was in a relationship with her at the time. And we weren't getting on very well.
Happy place.
Yeah. But we stayed in this beach for ages, and I realized, like, at about 1 o'clock in the morning, the sea went in a certain way that this little island of sand appeared like about 20 meters out from the little hut we were staying in. And I would take a chair on my own while my girlfriend was asleep, and I'd sit and watch the moon crossing the sky, sitting on this island,
beautiful,
this little island, and then the sea would swell and it would disappear again, and I'd have to wade back into the shore. And so that's where I go when I think of. I loved watching the sunrise and set, and I loved watching the moon, just the moon and going across the sky and being in your own land where your own laws applied, and you could do anything on the island, and no one could stop me. Unfortunately, there was no one else there to do anything with.
And there was nothing to do, yeah.
It was just some sand. Free. But in that moment, no outside laws. If there'd been
beautiful.
If a woman had washed up on shore, I'd have been able to make, if she wanted to make love with me, I'd have been able to make love with her, and it wouldn't have counted as cheating.
Oh, it doesn't count on your island.
I was on my island. So that's my happy place where I could go and be. But no, it didn't. No, there was no. Imagine if someone had washed up and hadn't spotted them, like Man Friday. They were on the others. They were just behind me on the island all the time.
Wow.
It was only the size.
Thinking, my world, my rules.
Yeah, it was the size of this table. I mean, I guess, you know, if I wanted to murder people and stuff, I could have done it then as well. And it was my island.
I think this is an extrapolation that isn't true. I think this is still basically subject to Thai laws. And I also think if your girlfriend at the time, if you'd have come back off that island and said, I've been sleeping with lots of women on my own island, I don't think she'd be like, oh, it doesn't count.
Yeah,
I think she probably would have been like, that does actually count.
Okay, well, that's your view, but that's... Where do you go when people tell you to go to a happy place?
Well, it's two things. When I was doing hypnobirthing, I used to imagine this pool that was like a cool pool of fresh water with like willows overhanging it and lots of moss and kind of greeny blue water that I could just put my feet in. But I imagine two things. The first thing is me and my friend Daniel used to go swimming a lot in Coney Island. Whenever I would see him, we would go to Coney Island to go swimming. And we had this amazing swim in like May where the water was cold, but the air was warm. And we both got out and were like, that was exactly what I needed. It was like so perfect. And like, I can see it, I guess, in my mind's eye. And then I always think of this one time. So we got out. And then where we'd been standing a foot away, a seagull swooped down and picked out this gigantic sand eel from the sand.
Right.
Just where we'd been standing, this fucking massive great thing had been under the sand. And I remember us both being like horrified, but kind of amazed, like, and I think of that day, I don't know why, it just was so perfect and unusual.
And if you'd murdered Daniel during that day, it wouldn't have counted as murder.
It wouldn't have counted, no.
That's fine.
And that's what I like to dwell on when I'm in my happy place, is that I could have committed a murder. That's what makes me feel calm.
I've never thought of that before. It's just I realised, you know, that by the rules, I could have. I didn't want to murder anyone, but I could have murdered someone.
You could have, yeah.
Now I realise. And it would have been.
Was this pre 9/11?
Yeah, it was. It would be, I think.
So it was in a different time.
It was a different time. It was basically, I mean, it was just in this millennium, but it was basically the last millennium. It feels like a long time.
It was the long 90s.
It feels like a long time ago, but then again, you know, it wasn't when you talk about. And that's the terrible thing about getting middle aged. I think like it's 20. Was it 21 years? It must be 21 years since Time, Gentlemen, Please, which was where the time when I was going out with Julia, finished. Like, and then you go, fucking hell, that doesn't feel like 21 years. But then thinking of that story, that does feel like 21 years. So time, that you play around with time, you know, you have these ideas of time and sort of the kind of time travel in this book as well. So,
yeah, I had a really weird feeling, which was I remembered the first time I went to Melbourne Festival, which was in 2007, and I was 25 years old. And there was a comedian there who was an older guy who was like inappropriate with me.
Right.
And it was very sad for me because I was like, oh, I thought this guy was like interested in me, but he wasn't. It was like a bait and switch. I was like, oh no, this is really disappointing.
Yeah.
And I remember to my mind, this person who I'd like really liked when I was a child, I was like, ugh, like this is such an old, sad man. And then I realized two things this year in Melbourne. Firstly, I first came to Melbourne 16 years ago.
Yeah.
And the difference between my childhood when I'd seen this person and seeing him was 17 years.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, that's no time at all. Like, oh. And I remember thinking, like, when I'd watched him on TV, it was like 1989 or something, and thinking, like, oh, that's like another world, you know, in 2006. And then me thinking now, 2023 does not feel crazy far away from 2007 in that same way. And then I was like, yeah, but he must have been 50 odd. And I looked him up and he was 42.
Right.
And I was like, because I'm 41. I was just like, no, I'm still vital and young.
Yeah.
I was like, just thank God I'm not like coming under 23-year-olds, because that would really be some gross memories for them, you know.
Give it time, Josie. Give it time. That midlife crisis will kick in properly.
I've got time, haven't I? I can get on the wine.
Thank God I met my wife when I was 40, and so I've been spared. I've been spared from being. There was another author wrote a similar thing about a respected but unnamed comedian who just was inappropriate with her. And then I asked her who it was, and I found out who it was, and it really made me unhappy.
I think I might even know who we're talking about.
Yeah.
And it's sad, isn't it?
Makes me so unhappy. Yes. But there we go. But so we're all flawed, and we can all turn things around. Maybe not. See, so yeah, but this is the beauty of this book, and these things that
I'm just coughing up some phlegm because I
was
lovely. Laughing.
That's all right. I'm glad to help get the phlegm out. I think the beauty of this book is it does, you know, it makes you think outside of the book itself, and it makes you think about all these sort of things. So it did a lot of it resonated. I think, you know, even like, I think these things that you say may come from ADHD. I think a lot of people, certainly parents, I think will really, you know, recognize a lot of stuff in it.
I think it's not, I mean, I don't think it's something that only neurodivergent people would relate to. Absolutely. Like, it's just about living in my life, really. Richard, I'm really grateful to you for reading it. Thank you.
No, I enjoy it. I love it. The lovely thing about this is I'm getting to read lots of books, and, you know, I only talk to people if I like them.
If you like it.
I like them. So it's you know, you're all right. It'll be all right. And you've got a lot of fantastic quotes, like hundreds of fantastic quotes. You've got everyone, like Dawn French, Joanna Lumley, A.L. Kennedy. What a spread of James Acast. It is. You've done very well. You can only do that once, though, Josie. You can't go with the next one, say, can I have another quote?
Don't be a hoary old naysayer. Don't be telling me about all the sad parts of it. I don't want to life hard
enough. It is.
Listen, next time I'm getting a quote from the Archbishop of Canterbury.
That's true, you can make fun.
I'm getting a quote from the President of Finland. I'm not going for authors. No, I'm going for top brass.
I think that's a very good idea. Are you
the American military?
Good. Are you working on anything else? Have you got more up your sleeve, or are you resting on your laurels?
Well, do you know what's bleak is at this present moment? I would really love to write a novel, and I would love to write more short stories. Am I currently writing them? No, I'm doing my stand-up tour and this tour, and I'm parenting my little children, and that's more than enough that I can cope with. I think my focus in the autumn is going to be trying to write some scripts and trying to just beg people yet again to let me make a show. I hope that will happen. Next year, I think I would like to start trying to write more fiction again. But it's really interesting. And it's like that feeling of when you do your first stand-up show, where basically all your life up till that point goes into that stand-up show. And then the next stand-up show, you're like, I guess June till July this year will be the inspiration for this show. So it's interesting to see, like, but I think there were a few things that I was going to put in the book that I didn't quite feel ready for as a writer.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I just wasn't able to do them in a convincing enough way. And I'm really hoping that maybe this time around that might be the case, that I could do the few little bits that I've not done yet. And also, the best thing about kids, they just grow up and up, you know? Just going to write about it.
You're right about it. They start saying stuff you can just rip off and use.
Oh, yeah. I want them to start saying the funniest things.
Yeah, they do. They start saying them, and then it's good. And then from there on in, it's all
And then
fine.
When they're 25, you can write shows about what a terrible time you're having with them or something.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think probably 12. To be honest, my daughter from the age of 2 has been, you know, sarcastic to me. So I don't know what she's going to be like when she's a teenager. Maybe it'll switch the other way around and she'll be delightful. But I have a feeling that now, I know you're
ready
to
be absolutely eviscerated.
Oh God, yeah. I mean, she's already it's already happening. I mean, I think she likes me. I have a bit in my show about whether she actually likes me. I think she does, and that's the sort of theme go through this show about me losing my testicles, but is my relationship with my daughter. But yeah, but also the problem is because I find her being funny so funny that she doubles down. So, you know, it's my way of approving her, but it's still really, it hurts you in a way you're not expecting, because you sort of think your kids will just love you and want to kiss you, and at least when they're little and adore you, and they, you know, they're little people and they make their own decisions about who they like and who they don't like.
Yeah.
And as you, I think you say in the book, we live in a world where you know, in the past for us, if there was a relative you didn't like, and that you go on, give him a kiss, give him, you can't, if my daughter doesn't want to kiss me, I can't go, you have to kiss me, I'm your brother.
You're not Lawrence Fox.
I'm going to go, that's fine. I don't need a hug. I love you. I love you. I love you. When you're ready, I'm here.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, it's so cruel, isn't it? It's the same for me. Like, I spend my life being like, do you want to cuddle? And also, you can't even be a dick about it. You have to just be like, great. Thanks for telling me. Thanks.
I wish we lived in the 1980s. What a great time it was.
Parenting era.
You could smack kids. It was great.
If you lived in the 80s, it was perfectly fine just to let your kids out on their own.
Yeah.
You'd leave them in the house, go and get a drink at the pub. Oh!
Incredible. We got. Well, I got through. You were alive in the 80s, weren't you? But only as a barely sentient thing.
No, as a child. I mean, I was literally being parented in the 80s.
That's true. You were a proper child. I was a
teenager in the 80s. Yeah. No, it's very interesting. I think a bit about that, about how, like, there are things that I believe would be safe for my daughter that I still wouldn't do because it's not culturally the done thing.
Yeah.
Like, I think at 5, she would be safe to go to the little shop that is 50 yards away and get herself a sweetie or something.
Yeah.
But I probably wouldn't do that until she was a bit older, just because it feels like nobody else would allow their child to do that. Do you know what I mean?
I do, but I can't imagine, you know, I can't imagine. I don't know what point we were allowed to go and do things on our own, but it was much younger than I'd be happy letting my kids
Go to the park. Me and my sister, I have a memory of being about 4 or 5 and going with my sister to the shop because she was trying to buy a cigarette. One cigarette.
And I think me and my brother and sister used to go, sometimes get the bus to Middlesbrough. My brother and sister were a bit older than me, but... my grandparents lived in Middlesbrough. I have a memory of going on a bus with just my brother and sister to Middlesbrough. Wow. I may be making up because we usually drove. I came out of listening to Matthew Perry's fascinating but awful audiobook, which I have talked about a little bit, which he is sent by plane to between his parents and
on his own.
Yeah, but he blames that for how his life turned out. But I think I was okay being put on the bus with my brother and sister. But maybe I wasn't.
This could be the first part of unraveling a terrible.
Have you read that Matthew Perry book? You've got to give that.
No, I haven't. But I like him a lot. I should read it.
You won't like him after you've read it.
Oh, no, really?
Well,
what's it like?
I mean, I mentioned it a little bit. He's been through a lot and should have learnt some lessons. And I don't think he's really, he thinks he's learnt some lessons, but he hasn't.
No lessons learned.
He hasn't really learnt any lessons. There's a very funny thing. I was thinking Bill Burr, but I think it might be that American comedian, Norm MacDonald. I think it might be. Talking about how Chandler, how Matthew Perry invented sarcasm, thinks he invented sarcasm. They called it a Matty or something. He called this thing a Matty, and he went, "Do you mean sarcasm?" Matt jokes. Anyway, that's not in the book. That's on Google somewhere. Talking of other books, and I do recommend Matthew Perry's book. Do listen to it. It's absolutely. I love reading books by people with little to no self-awareness, and they're usually comedians. I know you're a big book reader. Is there anything that you have read recently that you would like to recommend to our listeners?
Oh, God. Do you know what I love? I don't want to undermine, because I loved hearing you say that I was a big book reader. And I feel that it's a constituent part of my identity. But honestly, the amount of reading I've done of late, it's embarrassing. I'm reading Fern Brady's book, and I really love it. I think it's wonderfully written, absolutely wonderfully, and really interesting. I have started reading the new, Max Porter book. Okay. Called Shy, that I'm really loving. What's really exciting about that is, I think Max Porter must be about my age, and it's about being a teenager in the 90s and about a little bit and about drum and bass music and things like that. And so it's really thrilling that literary authors my age are like canonizing experiences that I had. I really enjoyed that. My friend Monica Heisey wrote a really, really, really funny novel that's really great called... Really Good, actually, is what it's called.
Okay.
It's about being a young divorcee.
Oh, yes.
Which I really loved. I'm trying to think. I have managed to read bits and bobs. I just haven't read as much as I would like, which is deeply frustrating for me. I finally started reading Black Jacobins by C.L.R. James, which is about the Haitian Revolution. But it's incredibly compelling in how it's written. But again, it's just about such deeply powerful, affecting, brutal, horrendous things that, like, you can't just read it. You have to read three pages and then be like,
right, yeah,
wow. And also because it is still like an academic book, it's not like a literary book. Like, this is the first time I've been reading a non-fiction book really since my little baby.
Yeah,
I thought going hard.
Yeah, that is pretty full on. I find since I've had kids. You know, and I never thought this would happen, but I just find certain subjects just too much to bear. And it's not exactly that, because of my kids, but I've got a lot more, wussy about what I'm prepared to look at.
It softens you, doesn't it?
And subjects that I don't want to dwell on. But I force myself at times to go into those. So those sound fantastic. Brilliant. Look, Josie, it's lovely to see you, and I'm glad you're so happy and everything's so great.
Oh,
and well done on the book. I do recommend it. It's called I'm never gonna remember what it's called. It's called Because I Don't Know What You Mean and What You Don't.
Can I tell you the reason?
Yeah, tell me the reason. That. I want to know. I was glad to ask.
Firstly, I love Raymond Carver. I think he's like a master of the short story genre. And his books, to me, I love the titles. They're sort of like, so he's got like, Will You Please Be Quiet, Please? He's got What We Talk About When We Talk About Love. He's got another one that I can't remember the name of, but it's similar. And I just really love that they're like quite long, difficult, repetitive things. And this was a line in one of the stories. And it's about like this woman, she's not sure what's going on in this kind of tryst. So I loved it. I was like, because I don't know what you mean and what you don't. I just love it. And then it reminds me of when I named my first daughter and we didn't realize that we were mispronouncing the name. And every time I meet someone, they're like, oh, is her name this? And I'm like, no, it's like that, but we say it differently. And I feel like with this, like the first interview I did about this book, it's not come out yet, but it was with a really brilliant journalist who was talking to me about it. And she, the first thing she said was like, I can't get on with this title. And I was like, oh, fuck. I think it's really wonderful and I'm proud of it and I stand by it.
Good. I'm glad you do. Thank you very much to the wonderful Josie Long. Do buy her book. And thank you also to Chris Evans, not that one. And Ben Evans. Why not? Let's thank Ben Evans, not that one. And we'll be back next time with another author. Who knows who will be next time?
I love that I'm an author as well. It's very exciting.
You are. You're officially an author.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Thanks for listening. RichardHerring.com/gigs. GoFasterStripe.com for all my books, downloads, all that sort of shizzle. Oh, yeah, I know all the cool words. And would love to see you on the Can I Have My Ball Back tour if you can make it. Bye.